Listen to another in the series of discussions by English philosopher Bertrand Russell on living in an atomic age. First, an important note. In response to popular demand, The Great Fraud returns to ABC tonight. It's a timely series of reports by Mrs. Ada Siegel, authority on the USSR and its people, which exposes the way the Soviet government constantly defrauds its citizens. Mrs. Siegel reveals false items printed in the Soviet press. She reports USSR developments in domestic and international policies since the death of Premier Stalin, and includes a forecast of future trends under the Malenkov regime. For a clearer understanding of Russia and its political policies, don't miss The Great Fraud a little later this evening on ABC. In cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation, the Public Affairs Department of the American Broadcasting Company presents transcribed the fourth in a series of six lectures entitled Living in an Atomic Age by the distinguished English philosopher, mathematician, sociologist, and author Bertrand Russell. The subject of the fourth lecture is The Limits of Human Power. Lord Russell.
The humility of the ancient shepherds, who felt themselves subject to the influences of Pleiades, is no longer appropriate in the scientific world. But there is a danger lest it should be replaced by a species of arrogance towards nature, which can lead to great disasters. Man, however scientific he may be, is not omnipotent. He is hedged in by natural limits. By means of his knowledge and technique, he can diminish the narrowness of these limits, but he can never remove them wholly. Some astronomers try to cheer us up in moments of depression by assuring us that one fine day the sun will explode, and in the twinkling of an eye we shall all be turned into gas. I do not know whether this is going to happen, nor when it will happen if it does happen. But I think it is safe to say that if it does, it will be a matter outside human control, and that even the best astronomers will be unable to prevent it. This is an extreme example, and one which it is useless to think about, because there is no way in which human behavior can be adapted to it. It does, however, serve one purpose, which is to remind us that we are not gods. There are two very different elements in science: scientific knowledge and scientific technique. Those whom I am calling technocrats are interested solely in scientific technique, and the more extreme among them deny that there is such a thing as scientific knowledge, or indeed any kind of knowledge. There are many who think that the point of view of the technocrat suffices, or if at moments they feel it somewhat arid, they supplement it not by any doubt that can be entertained by a scientific inquirer, but by an unscientific form of arrogance, namely, the belief that without the patience and without the submission involved in observing nature, we can arrive by a form of self-assertion at kinds of knowledge which science is incapable of supplying. This is megalomania. Man is neither impotent nor omnipotent. He has powers, and his powers are surprisingly great, but they are not so great as he might wish. But let us have done with these generalities. It is not the generalities, but their practical application with which I am concerned. How long will it be before the accessible oil in the world is exhausted? Will all the arable land be turned into dust bowls, as it has been in large parts of the United States? Will the population increase to the point where men again, like their remote ancestors, have no leisure to think of anything but the food supply? Such questions are not to be decided by general philosophical reflections. Communists think that there will be plenty of oil if there are no capitalists. Some religious people think that there will be plenty of food if we trust in Providence. Such ideas are superficial, even when they are called scientific, as they are by the communists. Modern industry depends upon raw materials which are found at or near the Earth's surface. These raw materials are the product of past geological ages. For the most part, they are not being reproduced by any natural process. The elements were built up long ago by a process which we are just beginning to understand. At temperatures much lower than that at which they were formed, they entered into chemical combinations. At a certain stage, the earth was at a temperature peculiarly suitable to the formation of complex chemical combinations, and at last, combinations were formed which had the properties that are characteristic of living matter. Living matter has a curious property which I have called chemical imperialism. In virtue of this property, when it is put into a suitable environment, it transforms a mass of dead matter into a mass of living matter. It is this property which has made organic evolution possible. There are in nature processes of synthesis. They proceed from the simpler to the more complex. The processes of modern industry do exactly the reverse. They use complex raw material and simplify it. So far, this process of simplification is in the main not reversible by scientific methods. It may be that it will become so. Many ages ago, the energy supplied by the sun's heat was transformed into luxuriant vegetation. The energy lay locked up in the layers of petrified tropical ferns until ruthless industrialists seized it and transformed it back again into heat. But the heat that we generate when we burn coal is not localized like the heat in the sun and is not continually regenerated by atomic processes. It floats off into the atmosphere and becomes forever useless. There is no process in nature, and there is none imaginable to human ingenuity, by which heat, once diffused, can be reconcentrated, or by which, when diffused, it can serve any human purpose. All sources of energy upon which industry depends are wasted when they are employed, and industry is expending them at a continually increasing rate. Already, coal has been largely replaced by oil, and oil is being used up so fast that East and West alike conceive it necessary to their own prosperity to destroy the industry of the other. Modern industry, in fact, is a kind of rape. All the long geological and astronomical ages during which the materials which we find useful have been built up contribute a moment's blaze, a moment's frivolous exuberance. But when his fireworks are finished, what will become of industrial man? All this, of course, does not appear in practice in the tragic and catastrophic form in which I have been stating it. What we know is that the price of coal goes up, and we do not readily connect this fact with the second law of thermodynamics. If you look up this law in a textbook, you will learn that it states that entropy always increases. And if you are not a physicist, you will not be much the wiser. But the law can be stated more simply, and is stated more simply by proverbial wisdom. It states, in fact, that you cannot unscramble eggs. It deals with all the irreversible processes of nature. Some processes are reversible, some are not. If you travel from London to Edinburgh, you can also travel from Edinburgh to London. But if coal is used to make your train go, there is no way by which you can collect the heat which it generates and turn it back into coal. All industry depends upon such irreversible processes. It all uses up the earth's capital. Modern industry is, in fact, a spendthrift, and sooner or later must suffer the penalty of spendthrifts. I know that most people meet such considerations with a kind of facile optimism. They say, oh, the men of science are sure to think of some clever invention, and even if they don't, it will last my time. They feel like the proverbial Irishman who said, why should I do anything for posterity? It never did anything for me. But I am concerned in these talks with man, considered as a single creature with a single biography. I cannot be content with a brief moment of riotous living, followed by destitution. And however clever the scientists may be, there are some things that they cannot be expected to achieve. When they have used up all the easily available sources of energy that nature has scattered carelessly over the surface of our planet, they will have to resort to more laborious processes, and these will involve a gradual lowering of the standard of living. Modern industrialists are like men who have come for the first time upon fertile virgin land and can live for a little while in great comfort with only a modicum of labor. It would be irrational to hope that the present heyday of industrialism will not develop far beyond its present level. But sooner or later, owing to the exhaustion of raw material, its capacity to supply human needs will diminish, not suddenly, but gradually. This could, of course, be prevented if men exercised any restraint or foresight in their present frenzied exploitation. Perhaps, before it is too late, they will learn to do so. But this is a question of politics, and I do not wish, as yet, to consider the political aspects of our problem. So far, I have been considering the raw materials of industry, but the matter is far more grave as regards soil, which is the raw material of food. Ever since agriculture began, it has been carried on wastefully in most parts of the world. Where methods are completely primitive, the cultivator merely moves on after he has exhausted the soil of one piece of land. This requires, of course, a great deal of available territory, and even then only offers a permanent solution if the damage done to the soil by cultivation is temporary and not permanent. It is no wonder that men worship fertility divinities, or that they developed a belief in the magical efficacy of human sacrifice. But in former times, while the population of the globe was still sparse, the problem had not the tragic importance that it has in our own day. We all know that the price of food goes up, but most of us attribute this to the wickedness of the government. If we live under a progressive government, it makes us reactionary. If we live under a reactionary government, it turns us into socialists. Both these reactions are superficial and frivolous. All governments, whatever their political complexion, are at present willy-nilly in the grip of natural forces which can only be dealt with by a degree of intelligence of which mankind hitherto has shown little evidence. Man has existed for about 1 million years, and scientific technique for at most 200 years. Seeing what it has already accomplished, it would be very rash to place any limits upon what it may accomplish in the future. But scientific knowledge is an intoxicating draught, and it may be one which the human race is unable to sustain. It may be that, like the men who built the Tower of Babel in the hope of reaching up to heaven, so the men who pursue the secrets of the atom will be punished for their impiety by providing by accident the means of exterminating the human species, and perhaps all life on this planet. From some points of view, such a consummation might not be wholly regrettable. But these points of view can hardly be ours. Perhaps somewhere else, in some distant nebula, some unimportant star has an unimportant planet on which there are rational beings. Perhaps in another 1 million years, their instruments will tell them of our fate and lead them to agree on an agenda for a conference of foreign ministers. If so, man will not have lived in vain.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the fourth in a series of 6 lectures by Bertrand Russell, entitled Living in an Atomic Age. The subject of Lord Russell's lecture tonight, The Limits of Human Powers. Be sure to listen next week when the 5th lecture will be presented by Lord Russell on the subject, Conflict and Unification. This has been a transcribed feature of the Public Affairs Department of ABC, in cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation. Your program came from New York. This is ABC Radio Network.